This is DW News, live from Berlin. Mission impossible again. Britain's Prime Minister buys more time for Brexit. Theresa May is back in Downing Street after getting an extension from the EU. Her mission to persuade Parliament to back her withdrawal deal. But amid growing fears that she won't get her plan passed, lawmakers, Parliament may now be asked to vote on a variety of alternative Brexit options next week. Also on the programme, a critical and desperate situation. The UN says hundreds of thousands of flood survivors need urgent help after Cyclone Idai leaves devastation in its wake. And we'll meet a couple of rugby fans planning a road trip to this year's Rugby World Cup from England to Japan by bike. I'm Phil Gale. Welcome to the programme. We start in the United Kingdom, where Prime Minister Theresa May is trying to come up with a new way to save her Brexit deal. European Union leaders agreed to delay the start of delay the date of Britain's withdrawal from the Union beyond next Friday. The Prime Minister was then expected to resubmit her deal to Parliament for a third time. However, reports now suggest that Theresa May could skip this and instead her government could ask Parliament to take part in a series of indicative votes. These would offer a majority decision on the final direction Brexit should take. EU Council President Donald Tusk welcomed the EU's unanimous decision to give Britain more time because, as he said, every option is still on the table.
As regards Brexit, the European Council formalised last night's decisions by the EU 27 and the UK to delay the cleavage and allow for an extension. Personally, I am really happy about this development. As I said yesterday, it means that until the 12th of April, anything is possible. A deal, a long extension, if the UK decided to rethink its strategy, or revoking Article 50, which is a prerogative of the UK government. The fate of Brexit is in the hands of our British friends.
Let's go to Brussels then, where we join our friend DW correspondent Barbara Vasil. Welcome, Barbara. So the decision to delay Brexit was unanimous, but was the meeting harmonious? Because they did seem to take an awfully long time.
It took an awfully long time for one simple reason, Phil. I mean, these are 27 prime ministers, presidents and chancellors, and every single one of them thinks they're very important. And they finally really need to sort of hash it out, talk about Brexit, say what they maybe think about Theresa May after she had left the room, put a date on the table. At one point, a diplomat joked that there were so many dates on the table, it was like Tinder. And then finally sort of figure out what could be the strategy, you know? We need a strategy. That finally, after some hours, emerged. Dinner was postponed, and then they sat down and said, OK, we give them two deadlines, just as you have just shown us, a short one where they need to really push it, and then maybe if they get it done, then they can have a bit more time to figure out the legal niceties. And that is the strategy. We don't want to be held hostage by the Brexit crisis anymore, said Francis Emmanuel Macron, and right he is.
Okay, so leaders now, I suppose we just wait and see what Theresa May and what the British Parliament do next.
That is right, because, as we heard Donald Tusk say, it's in the hand of our British friends. It has been in their hands all the time, but they let the ball drop over and over again. Now in Brussels, the hopes are higher that Theresa May might be under so much pressure or might even be kicked out of office or a miracle might happen that finally something begins to move. Now, there are two varieties of things, two variations of things that can happen next week. One is, as you indicated, the Brexit deal can be brought back. Now, we hear in the meantime that Theresa May might step back from that because she realizes that she would get a bloody nose again, because the two sides in Parliament, the Conservatives and the opposition, have dug themselves in and say, we will not do this, not over our dead bodies. So that is the one thing. What happens next? There might be, and there are sort of negotiations about this and ideas on the table, a series of so-called indicative votes. That means it's like a parlor game. You put everything on the table, and then the speaker says, do you want Brexit with the customs union? And then people walk out of one side of parliament or the other. Do you want Norway? Do you want no Brexit? Do you want to revoke Article 50? And so on and so forth. 7 variations. And after that, they could then go back to Brussels and say, see, we figured out what we really want. However, they could have done this some months ago.
Okay, so all our futures hang on a parlour game. Presumably, though, Brussels, given the political impasse in London, Brussels is preparing for Brexit to happen on the 12th of April and for the effectively everything to just end there.
They've done so furiously for some months already. I mean, since before Christmas, even the European Commission has passed numerous laws and legislations to figure out the rules. Can British trucks roll on the continent? How are planes going to fly? Because open skies, the airline agreement ends with Brexit, and so on and so forth. It's an endless litany. And so they really have been doing their homework. Mario Draghi, the ECB president, he criticized some member states and said they haven't really done enough to prepare the economy. But Angela Merkel picked that up and said, if I look at Germany, I think industry really has done everything. They're well prepared. We know from the Dutch they're very well prepared. The French are trying to be well prepared. So everybody knows this could still go very wrong at the last minute. That means in 3 weeks' time, April 12th.
All right. Never a dull moment. For now, though, Barbara Vasel, thank you. Let's take a look now at some of the other stories making news around the world. The New York Times is reporting that the two Boeing 737 MAX airplanes that crashed in recent months were both missing the safety features for which Boeing had charged airlines extra. One of the features would have alerted pilots to a software malfunction that investigators say may have led to both disasters. Tens of thousands of protesters have returned to the streets of the Algerian capital to step up their calls for the president's immediate resignation. After months of demonstrations, President Abdelaziz Bouteflika reversed his plan to run for a fifth term, but, however, stopped short of stepping down. Police in Paris have banned yellow vest protesters from the Champs-Élysées on Saturday. That's a week after hundreds of anti-government demonstrators rioted and looted shops on the famous boulevard. The decision follows French President Emmanuel Macron's controversial decision to call in the army to quell the violence. Thousands of people in the Dutch city of Utrecht have held a memorial march for the victims of Monday's tram shooting. Prime Minister Mark Rutte was amongst the mourners. The gunman, who killed 3 people, has confessed to the attack. Authorities are still investigating his motive. And thousands of New Zealanders attended a memorial in Christchurch, marking a week since a gunman killed 50 people in a terror attack on 2 mosques in the city. Prayers were held at a park opposite the Al Noor Mosque, which was the target of one of the shootings. Now, meanwhile, women and men in New Zealand have been wearing headscarves in a display of solidarity with the country's Muslim community. Headscarf for Harmony was organised via social media, and DW reporter William Glucroft is here to tell us more. Welcome. What's the idea behind this?
Well, as we've seen a lot of outpouring of support and unity in New Zealand, and this is yet one more way that New Zealanders have been trying to come together. The Facebook page, Facebook event was launched, Headscarves for Harmony, to encourage women of all kinds in New Zealand to put on the headscarf, men as well, but mostly women, especially today, the 1 week since the shooting at the mosque. Now, this was done in consultation with a few Muslim groups in New Zealand to make sure that this was an appropriate way for non-Muslims to show their support for their Muslim neighbors. We see here people posting selfies of themselves wearing the headscarf today, and also reasons why that they did it, what it meant to them. We also have a few examples here of women saying why they did it.
Hopefully it will be a sign of support to the woman that it is a right to come out into our community. They are part of our community, and going forward I think we'll need to give them a lot of support to make them realise that they are with us in this community.
Well, my primary reason was that if anybody else turns up waving a gun, I want to stand between him and anybody he might be pointing it at. And I don't want him to be able to tell the difference, because there isn't.
So what sort of response has that been?
Yeah, well, of course, when it comes to headscarves, it's a bit of a touchy subject. Headscarves are seen by some as a symbol of oppression within the Muslim community, forcing women to cover up. But when it comes to the context of just this particular situation, a lot of positive response, especially among the Muslim community. We see a few responses here online. The Headscarf for Harmony Facebook page itself: can't find enough words to thank you ladies for your support today. We really appreciate all what you've done for us. Always united. And here on Twitter: to all those who have chosen to wear the headscarf in solidarity today and those who choose to do this in other ways, know that you are legends. Respect with the hashtag #HeadscarfForHarmony that's been trending in New Zealand today. So it's just one of several ways that we've seen in the last week New Zealanders coming together to mourn this really horrific shooting that happened last week.
Mm-hmm. William Bluecroft, thank you so much. And cases of cholera have been reported in the Mozambican city of Beira following the catastrophic flooding triggered by Cyclone Idai. 8 days after the cyclone struck, the homeless, hungry and injured are slowly making their way to Beira from devastated inland areas. The city was itself heavily damaged, but has emerged as the nerve centre for rescue efforts in the country.
The harbour city of Beira is almost unrecognisable. It's been a week since Cyclone Idai devastated the mainland of East Africa. The fear of the cyclone has subsided, but the misery is overwhelming. Everything is in short supply.
We're starving. We're on some waiting list, but there is not enough aid. We're suffering, and no one is giving us anything.
Survivors from surrounding regions have been arriving by boat, hoping for support in the city. But almost 90% of Beira has been destroyed. Food prices have tripled in a short time. Food and medicine supplies are slow to arrive. The United Nations has given a bleak assessment.
The executive director described the scene on the ground as desperate, stating that the situation on the ground, and I'm quoting her, the situation on the ground remains critical. There is no electricity or running water. Hundreds of thousands of children need immediate help. The priority right now is to give them shelter, food, water, education, and protection.
The UN estimates that in Mozambique, as well as in neighboring Zimbabwe and Malawi, Idai affected well over a million people, half of them children. While many are waiting for humanitarian aid, tens of thousands are still trapped by the floods that followed the cyclone. There simply aren't enough helicopters to rescue everyone. Even if the rescues are successful, the danger isn't over. NGOs warn of contaminated water that could quickly lead to a cholera outbreak.
Now, this year's Rugby World Cup is being hosted by Japan. It doesn't start until September, but for two avid England fans, the trip to Tokyo starts today. They are cycling there and hoping to raise money for charity in the process.
From London to Tokyo. As the crow flies, it's over 9,000 kilometres, but George Cullen and Ben Cook will be on their bikes, passing through 21 countries, all for a good cause.
I think it's a chance to go and see the world, first and foremost, by bike. You know, you're literally in a country, feeling all the hills, meeting all the people. So it's probably the best way to go and travel. And then the chance to raise some money as well. So raising money for the Movember Foundation and the Ian Williams Foundation, looking to raise £30,000.
If all goes to plan, they'll arrive just in time for the Rugby World Cup in September. In order to make it, they're travelling light, along with this one luxury item.
Like I said, it's self-sustained, so it's pretty simple. The only things that we need to resupply along the route are food and water. So as long as we've got those two things, then we should be, in theory, good to go.
In 6 months' time, these two could be cheering on their rugby heroes after the ride of a lifetime.
And coming up next here on DW, DW Business and Italy. Taking a look at Italy bringing China's new Silk Road infrastructure project to the heart of Europe. But there are concerns within the EU about Beijing's growing political clout. Christoph Kober will have that story and the rest of the day's business news. And there'll be more world news updates at the top of the hour. Have yourself a good day and a wonderful weekend.